imagine somebody's on a vast painting canvas, right? And let's say there are a bunch of people who are all just finger painting on this thing. Okay. Let's just say it's an acre. Okay. Mm-hmm. And let's just say that there are 40 artists who've all been given a palette and they're all just, you know, slapping big swaths of paint on it, you know. And you go walking over the top of this, or maybe you can hover over the top of it, and you're like, this is a mess, you know. And you know what? Maybe it is. Maybe some of these artists are better than others. Maybe some of them have a different style than another. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, maybe some are classically trained and some are just to have some basic gifting, and others is just a 3-year-old kid who wants to go around and wallow in some paint, you know. Mm-hmm. And now you can critique certain sections of that, and you can say, man, this is just, you know, your brush strokes are way off here, especially mm-hmm. if you're very trained in artistic styles and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You can say, well, this is just a mess. Mm-hmm. But let's say now you can get in a helicopter, you can get up maybe 1,000 feet or maybe even a few hundred feet and look down on it. And a face comes into view. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is a portrait. Mm-hmm. Now, what would that say about that? You know, if you came upon that sort of a
right.
thing.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. And we're going to start a new series today called Redefining Faith.
Yes.
Or Redefining the Faith. One of the others.
Yeah, we haven't decided. We're workshopping yep. it.
Yeah, so people out there today are, as we hear in the news and talk to people, we hear about deconstruction.
Yeah.
I'm deconstructing my faith. And a lot of times, like, sort of like the more dramatic version of that is like, I'm basically leaving the faith. I'm deconstructing it. I'm tearing it down.
Yeah.
There's nothing left. I'm moving on. Right. What we would like for people to do is to deconstruct maybe a fundamentalism and erect in its place a more robust version of the Christian faith, really a more biblical version of the Christian faith.
Ironically.
So we're going to work through some of those key points of Christian theology, Christian doctrine over the coming weeks and attempt to do a refresh on every one of them.
Yeah.
So we're going to cover things like biblical inerrancy, literal interpretation, the Trinity, young earth versus old earth, original sin, election, incarnation, salvation, sanctification, Holy Spirit, church, eternal suffering, death and the intermediate state, the apocalypse. Oh my goodness, we're going to cover some ground.
Oh man, theology. This will be interesting.
Yeah, yes, theology.
You guys, send us your tuition. Right. Mail it in. Yeah.
You owe us.
That's right, yeah.
Today we begin with our episode entitled Basic Instructions for Leaving Earth, which is, of course, what the acronym BIBLE means.
Right.
Basic instructions.
Before leaving Earth.
Yeah. And the doctrine is biblical inerrancy, which is something yeah. like in the American Evangelical Church, you're just supposed to believe. It's just a tenet of the American Evangelical Church. The Bible is inerrant, not errant, without errors. Here's the misconception. The Bible is the only book dictated by the one true God. Its very words were spoken by God, and therefore it contains no errors of any kind. The instructions it contains should be followed uncritically.
Yeah, man. And maybe we're going to get more into that next time when we talk about biblical literalism and how we follow it. But probably for this time, focus on this notion of inerrancy and why that's formulated, I guess, why that becomes an article of faith, what reasons to believe that there might be, what reasons to not believe that there might be, and if that doctrine is untrue, what are we left with? Does that sound like a mm-hmm. kind of a ad okay. hoc outline?
Yeah, reasons to believe, reasons yeah. not to believe.
So why do you think so many faith statements and would have something about that, right? You've got your theological training, so you had some stuff, you had this formulation, right? You know?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. I mean, I think there's got to be some obvious sense that we've got to have a foundation.
Yeah.
We got to have a basis in something. Mm. And we turn to the Bible for that. So the Protestant tradition says, well, we don't turn to the church's teaching. We go back to the sources.
Yeah.
And the source is Scripture. Mm-hmm. And so therefore we need to shore up that source. We need to strengthen it and make sure that it's sure. Mm-hmm. And so we'll declare that it's inerrant, and we'll find verses which indicate that it's inerrant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and if there's errors in your book, I mean, what are the assumptions about the Bible? Okay, so if it's a book authored by God, would we expect to find mistakes? You know, does God own an eraser? You know, does he just have to write, you know, indelible ink? He doesn't have to worry about it. If we suppose that God is an infallible being, mm-hmm. and that the Bible is the book that he has written to humankind, what would we expect that book to be like? Mm-hmm. So that would certainly lend toward the argument for inerrancy, mm-hmm. that we ought to have that. And I think we as humans, we want an authoritative document that is, you know, both timeless and finite. Okay, we want something that the book is closed. It has been written. Okay, something about writing. It makes something official. It makes it permanent. It makes it unchanging. And we long for that. Maybe it's one of the reasons that people come to religious faith is to have a sense of permanence, right? Because there's this transitory nature to everything else. And things seem to be going so quickly. This idea that you can cling to something that is ancient and will go on beyond your existence on this planet anyway, it's appealing. And certainly if you're following an eternal being, he can grant you that. So the Bible is what, say, the Judeo-Christian tradition would claim, at least parts of it. And then but there are other religions, as we've mentioned, like Islam, you know, and Islam appears to me to be an answer to the human longing for a book worthy of us. So, you know, there are various problems, I think, inherent in the Bible itself. Regardless, no matter how conservative you may be, your understanding of the Bible and its genesis is inherently flawed. It can't serve the agenda of this manual that was given from on high.
Basic instructions before leaving Earth.
Right. Yeah. There are inherent problems. Let's set aside the more fine-tuned arguments against biblical inerrancy, and let's just look at the aspects of the Bible that kind of undermine its credibility, I think, in the minds of non-Christian or non-Jewish people, okay? And maybe even Christian and Jewish people. So this book was came through the hands of human beings. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's fine. There are no holy books that are not the product of somebody's hand writing it, right?
Right. I mean, even the Book of Mormon is claimed to not have been written by human hand, but right? We don't believe that.
But translated, though.
Oh, it was translated at least.
Translated by Joseph Smith, apparently, or according to, you know, Mormon doctrine, that the English version, and since there are no, you know, we don't have the golden tablets, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything in quote unquote Reformed Egyptian. You know, there's no textual criticism. We can't look back in the ancient languages and compare the English translation of the Book of Mormon with its original texts, mm-hmm. right? That's just not available to us. So for all intents and purposes, through a human hand, right? Mm-hmm. Inspired interpretation is roughly the same. Mm-hmm. So, And then you got the Islam, more recently, Neil Wallace, Conversations with God. So if you are a New Agey person, you want a God who's kind of fits this pluralist theme. There's a guy named Neil Wallis, and this has been, I mean, it's probably 20 years ago now, a little more. He just kind of, I think he's a seeker like all these guys, and sat down and just started, I guess, opening himself up to being spoken with by some entity and began writing, you know, on his legal pad. And so some people accept that as some kind of divine revelation. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing thing where we want a document that came from the divine being, and that's our longing. But the Bible is not like any of those other ones. So you, as biblically trained, how is the Bible different from the Book of Mormon, the Quran, and Neil Wallis's conversations?
Well, for one, it's got lots of different authors spread out over thousands of years.
Right. Right. And so we would say that's, I think from an apologist would say that's a good thing, right? It's an evidence of its transcendent authorship. What would a critic say, do you think?
A diversity of voices, a cacophony of, you know, points of view, contradictions, internal contradictions.
Yeah.
Obviously a human document. How could it be divine?
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. And there's, I think there's this problem with this, you know, if God wants to tell us something, why does he have to give it to us in installments? Mm-hmm. You know, if God has a message, a general revelation for all humankind in writing, you know, the very existence of the New Testament is problematic. And I think it really opened the door for the Quran. Because if God could you know, issue a major update that invalidates certain portions of a previous edition, if he could do it once, if he needs to do it once, why wouldn't he do it again? And so that calls into question God's foresight, his knowledge of us, his ability to provide a comprehensive, workable standard that's going to last through the ages. If he's got to give it in installments, especially if, you know, because there's this conundrum, if what's in the new book is essential, is critical, why did he deprive previous generations for thousands of years of this insight? That's problematic. If
what you're looking for is basic instructions before leaving Earth,
right,
a manual,
right,
a book.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if your eternal destiny turns on your conformity to the instructions written therein, and yet the instructions are being given in installments, did the previous people go to heaven? You know, if they did, why is God bothering us with a whole new set of things? Is he moving the goalpost back? If, you know, if they didn't, why did he deprive them of that opportunity? You know, how genuinely can we celebrate our exalted place knowing that we're standing on the backs of the damned whom God used to bring us to this place of erudite insight into him and to his not, you know, into what he's like, at their expense? That doesn't seem very fair either. You know, there's a lot of problems with this idea that the Bible was revealed over time. It does suggest that God is opaque and he's withholding. And for seemingly, it's difficult to find some really good reasons for that. And we can say, well, humankind is maturing and evolving and stuff. But, you know, honestly, was there really that much difference between Palestine in the first century and Palestine 1800 BC? You know, was it really that much difference in slavery was legal both eras. Women were still subjugated in both eras. I mean, life was roughly the same for that time period. So it's not like we're saying, hey, you know, oh, we had to mature as a species or something in that time. It just doesn't seem to have happened. Also, you know, we could say, well, from a say a salvation history standpoint or something, that some things had to be done. And I think that's true, you know. But if you look at the history of Israel, it's cyclical and not linear, progressive upward. It's not like, you know, there was this moment in the first century when the nation of Israel was so spiritual and so on fire for God because they'd been through this whole litany of backsliding and, you know, chastisement and restoration. And through every one of these cycles, they became more devoted to God, holier. It seems that they found themselves right back in the same place, to the point that they were willing to crucify their God. So this whole protocol, say 1400 year protocol of the nation of Israel, doesn't seem to have led the people to a place where they were ready to accept their Messiah. So all that to say, if we say, well, God was waiting to reveal the New Testament until Israel was ready to hear it, that doesn't seem to have happened. Or we could say, well, God was waiting to reveal the New Testament until humankind had reached a place of development. That doesn't seem to be true. So all that to say, if the problem with the Bible, I think, from at least a critical standpoint, is that this being revealed in installments, let's just assume that the very early, like the Ten Commandments, were given by Moses from Sinai, or through Moses, right? Let's assume that's true. We don't have any evidence that that's true. You know, all of that evidence is gone. Best evidence is that, I think, what was it? Like we didn't even have any full Hebrew texts, I don't think, until discovery of Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. A lot of those texts were destroyed and stuff like that. So we don't have any. Really, we didn't have any texts of the Hebrew scriptures that predated Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, some people, until Qumran, I think the oldest scrolls we had were like 1000 AD. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, so that's there's not this provenance that we can say, okay, this is clearly, you know, this has been passed from person to person and it goes all the way back to, you know, 1400 BC or whatever. So we don't know for sure who even wrote these books, right? But let's just say that the first installment came from Sinai after the people came forth. Let's just say that's true, okay? But then, I mean, the last book is, in terms of chronology, is likely what? Maybe Isaiah or something, right? So we're talking about during, or I guess it would have been like Daniel, right? Yeah, it had to have been like Daniel or Esther. So, you know, during the captivity. So how many years is that? 1100? You know? Or
from where? 1100 from where?
No. It's, yeah. Well, let me see. It would be like 900, right? From, let's say that Israel leaves Egypt in 1400, around there, BC. Okay. And then they go into Babylonian captivity, 586. Some of these books are written from Babylonian captivity, so let's just say 550, right? So what are you talking, 800 years or so?
To what?
From the beginning? Between 1400 to 550, okay. BC, yeah. Right? 850 years. Okay. Man, you know, let me see. What were we doing 850 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The United States wasn't here. I think we were in the three pope period back in, in medieval period, mm-hmm. era. Okay. We hadn't had the Reformation. Mm-hmm. We were pretty backward in terms of development and stuff like that. So, that's a lot can happen in that time. Right. But that's the length of time that if we look at just the Hebrew scriptures, not counting the New Testament, that's a lot of time. Right. And God is supposedly revealing himself and over that time. So, all that to say is that inherently the concept of the Bible as we have it doesn't stack up to a lot of people's expectation for God revealing himself in print.
Okay. So all of that was to say these are problems with a view of the Bible as inerrant.
Right.
Like a divine book that God himself wrote.
Right.
Like, why would he write a book this way?
Right.
And yeah. And they're all, it's all based on the idea that every word in the Bible is God's chosen word. Mm-hmm. There, it really minimizes human authorship. It essentially eliminates human authorship, this view of biblical inerrancy.
Right.
I mean, of course, people who would actually defend inerrancy, they would say the Bible was recorded by humans. Mm-hmm. But those humans were guided by God such that every word they wrote is exactly what he meant to, for them to write, and it contains no error of any sort. Now, I'm sure that people will have nuances of the, of their definition of inerrancy. Sure. I believe that there are some out there to the effect that there can be sort of historical inaccuracies, even though every word is what God intended.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and sometimes I think in the more scholarly circles, we would say it's inerrant in its autographs, right?
So, well, yes. Yeah.
So, we allow for translation and transcription errors, right?
Right.
But then where did God go, right? Why did he allow that? You know, I mean, hey, there are a lot of people in the, you know, in the deep backwoods of Kentucky that are died from snake bites because someone put Mark 16, 9 through 20 in the Bible. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Why would God allow that to happen? Are those people to be faulted for just reading the text that they were told is from God and taking up snakes and drinking poison, or are the rest of us to be faulted for not having that kind of faith? And if they died, then whose fault is it? Mm-hmm. You know, that these things kind of become problematic. And then there are things that are variations that are very, you know, very old, like, you know, the whole John chapter 8, woman taken in adultery. That's almost universally seen now as not authentic to John. And yet we retain it because we like that story, you know, but it's seems clearly to not have originated with the author of the rest of that gospel. And it's kind of a hindrance to understanding the surrounding passages because it displaces, it separates what follows that story from what precedes it. And you really, in order to understand what follows that story, you really needed what preceded it. But all of a sudden there's this parenthetical that just kind of wrecks your train of thought. And so that's problematic. 1 John 5:7.
That's problematic because it looks like God didn't protect the transmission of the Bible down through the ages.
Right, yeah. I mean, every copy of the Bible 100 years ago or whatever, 150 years ago, would have had that included in the rest of the text. Uh-huh. Would have had Mark 16, 9 through 20 in the text. Uh-huh. 1 John 5:7 in the text.
And now we've got more critical studies available mm-hmm. to us, and now we have notes in our Bibles that tell us these, the oldest and most reliable transcripts don't contain these passages.
Right, right. So before that, everybody went on the assumption that that was biblical. Uh-huh. And, you know, you could say, well, on the whole, it's not a big deal. It's, you know, it's roughly the same message. I get that, right? Except Mark 16, 9 through 20, you know, the people who actually took up snakes and stuff like that, then that's a problem. And I don't know what to do with that. But at any rate, that's if the Bible was intended to be our primary revelation, there's just some problems with it. One, that's the idea of how it came to us. It does kind of open itself up to criticism. It does kind of undermine its own credibility if you have installments over time. Also, if you see it, you receive it as the voice of God coming to you, and yet it's coming through, you know, human vocal cords, as it were, right? That the best translations, I mean, the best way to interpret the Bible is to look at it in its context, okay? So doesn't that suggest that the things that are written are contextual? The meaning of those words, that the genesis of those words, that if we're really going to understand it. So if you read a passage of the Bible, you know, everyone's favorite, one of the favorite Bible verses is Jeremiah, what is it?
Like 29:11?
Yeah, 29:11. Yeah. Yeah,
so, for I know the plans I have for you.
Right, right. Now, if you open the Bible and you let it drop open and you're waiting for God to speak to you through these words, then that's to you. Right. In the context, it's not to you at all. You know, it's not even to an individual. You know, it's to the nation, and it is regarding, you know, as part of this letter that Jeremiah writes to the captives and saying, hey, you're going to be there a while. Settle down, build houses, pray for the peace of the land in which God has sent you, and then come back. Okay. So that's the overall context. It was never really addressed to the individual, the graduate, you know, from mm-hmm. high school or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that that's not true, but I think that if we take this position that it is that these are words directly from God into your ear, then we miss kind of a richer context that it's trying to tell us. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think that's a reason not to hold to this notion that it is God dictating his will to the individual, that we have to go to the trouble to place these passages in their context if we're going to understand what they meant in the first place. So, but if we do that, then aren't we conceding some ground when it comes to inerrancy? You know,
well, we're saying God gave us a story instead of God gave us a manual. Mm-hmm. And there's possibly a message for us in that story.
Right.
Or that story is leading to some event, and that's the message. And so, yet we seem to be giving up the view of Scripture as basic instructions for leaving Earth, manual for divinely inspired manual for what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we're also realizing. Yeah, I think when we contextualize it, we bring the human element back in.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read Paul, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to translate the letters, then I have to understand the occasion that they were, or try to ascertain, right? The occasion, what caused the writing of that letter.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's anything other than, you know, the voice of God saying, write a letter to the Galatians, then there's a very human element to this. You know, Paul's reason for writing, the mm-hmm. occasion of it, that mm-hmm. starts with Paul. Now, mm-hmm. so that's it begins to undermine this sense of the Bible as divine dictation, and it begins to bring back in this human element
mm-hmm.
into it. So there's another issue. So, for instance, if you read the Quran, you don't have to contextualize. You know, it's a bunch of isolated, you know, sayings that have nothing to do with what, you know, at least as far as we know, what Muhammad was going through at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or
it's not
what
a story.
His audience needed to hear. You know, it's not related to anything about the context. It's this, you know, I use this tongue in cheek, but timeless work, right? Mm-hmm. It's outside of time. It's not time bound. Even the Book of Mormon, which claims to have some kind of historical component, we don't really get any understanding of the people to whom it's written. Just a kind of a vast overarching narrative, right? But nothing, there's nothing about the occasion itself. So this is distinct. And, you know, of course, then you have the one voice coming through in these other quote unquote revelations. So, but if you're going to claim it's to be inerrant and yet with human authorship, that seems unlikely because, man, people got all kinds of things wrong back then, you know. And if God did want to educate us on things that we, you know, we didn't understand, he just didn't, you know, we weren't listening or he wasn't loud enough or something. It just seems like we were wrong about lots of stuff for centuries. And those people who were, you know, vastly our intellectual inferiors in terms of what they understood about the universe are supposed to tell us how to live today. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know. So
maybe that's why the need for inerrancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it seems like what we want is a book that is worthy of God. And so absent such a book, we will either, you know, conscript something we already have and try to force it to become that, or we will author something new and claim that it is that. That's because it's a product of human longing. More, I think, than God's desire to reveal himself. However long human history has gone on before that Sinai event, okay, people went on without a book. You know, does that mean that God was not present or wasn't somehow revealing himself before that time? That, you know, it's difficult to think that he would just intentionally leave everybody in total darkness about himself. If that's important, if knowing him is important, then you would think he would have had some mechanism to reveal himself. So really, if, you know, if the Hebrew scriptures are this moment when God gives us written revelation or, you know, whatever, that's a very small sliver of human history, even, you know, the history of civilization. You know, if we start marking, say, civilization with Sumerians back in 5000 BC or something, right? And then we come up to today, 2000 AD. So we've got 7,000 years to account for. Of that, maybe 1,400 were under a document, you know, to one very, very small set of people. You know, I mean, the Israel has always been small, you know. So from the river to the sea is still a very small strip of land, you know, in geopolitical terms and just world history and the influence on humankind. You know, had it not been honestly for the Christian message and evangelization, these people might have just disappeared into the dust like everybody else, you know. But somehow they've endured. But it certainly falls short of this, of a God who wants everybody to know him, if the Bible is the vehicle through which everybody must know him.
Right, so you're suggesting that it's not. So we've got, you know, you're really working with this idea that the Bible is, you know, is the written revelation of God and it's inerrant, and you're trying to push hard on that. But what you just said is that it's really problematic if that's the case. Mm-hmm. Your implication is that in fact the Bible is not
right
God's revelation, self revelation to the world.
Yeah. Well, it's not. Well, I would say it is a revelation of, mm-hmm. of himself, you know, and it serves its own. It serves its purpose. Mm-hmm. But it is not the revelation to humankind. So I would, one of the things I would see it as is very much like the Qumran scrolls. Okay, so the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered in. When were they discovered? Probably
40s, 50s, 60s. Yeah, I don't know.
Early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, there's all these scrolls and this pottery in this cave mm-hmm. in Qumran, which is this area, I guess, by the Dead Sea. There was a sect of people called the Essenes that lived out there. They were a desert community, and they had taken with them several of their holy books, and they'd kept and then they'd preserve them in these jars. And then jars were found by some little shepherd boy, and here we go, right? Until that time, we didn't have any anything corroborating the claim that Israel really had ever been a nation. There was a lot of effort, I think, made on the part of Muslims, especially in the 7th and 8th centuries AD, to kind of redact Israel's history and to claim that that region was always a Muslim region, and still to this day, it's a contentious matter. But when those scrolls were found, I mean, there were some crazy books in there and stuff like that, but and who's to say which ones were revealed or revelation or not, but some of them were like copies of Daniel, certain sections of Isaiah. So we, mm-hmm. we start to, you know, and these things are dating at least to about, what, the 2nd century B.C., so we know that there was a whole body of work before Jesus came, right? Mm-hmm. Hebrew scriptures. And we can assume, because Paul refers to sections, other New Testament authors refer to sections of their Bible that had come down to them, mm-hmm. and now we have some proof. So I say all that to say is that I think that the Bible serves somewhat of that kind of a purpose. Like it's this... it is this, what would you call it? It's like God is sealing away this oracle, this testament, if you will, or testimony to his intention. So if, let's say, I wanted to do something for my wife that showed great intention. Okay. I saw on Facebook the other day, there's a guy who, for a solid year, he took a picture secretly of himself holding an engagement ring with his wife in the background. Mm-hmm. So she'd be asleep and he'd put it on her back and he'd take a picture of her, you know, or they'd be talking and he'd be like, you know, selfie, mm-hmm. holding it kind of in front of him and she couldn't see it. And he did this for a whole year, mm-hmm. right?
He had the ring a year early.
He had the ring early so that when he asked her to marry him, right, and he actually pops the question, what he's got is a catalog with timestamps that say, you know, I've been planning this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so that all of a sudden in that moment, that year of preparation becomes very significant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it just comes with the weight of an entire 365 days all piled up into one day,
mm-hmm.
you know, into one moment. So, you know, if he were to say to her, instead of having done that, he's just got cold feet and he doesn't want to ask her, mm-hmm. but he's bought the ring and it was maybe, you know, maybe on a lark or something, right? And if he were to say to her, you know, I've been planning this for, you know, a whole year, and she would only have his word on that, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm sure she wouldn't doubt him, but it just wouldn't be as significant. So I see the Hebrew scriptures as being very much that. And really all the obscurity of those pictures, had he been publishing it on social media the whole time, it would have been really for another audience besides her,
mm-hmm.
you know? But when it's published all at once, it is for that other audience, but it is to say to that audience, here's how much I love my fiance,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, I think that I see the Hebrew scriptures as being like that. Here's something that's somewhat obscure, right? It's arcane. It's kind of buried in the mists of time. Waiting for this moment when a very public invitation is made. And I think that's how Paul saw, you know, the scriptures. So it's not about the details, right? It's not about grabbing every one of these photos and looking at them and looking at the composition of it and the lighting and, you know, critiquing that. Then that's silly, right? That would be like, what kind of photographer is this guy? I thought he was supposed to love his, you know, his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
It misses the point. And I think that Paul speaks of the Hebrew scriptures. He says, you know, what he asked in Romans 3, what's the benefit of being an Israelite? Because he's wrestling with these same questions. You know, if this is the full revelation of God, why has God not given it to his people for 1400 years? You know, what's the point? And if this revelation is available to everybody, Jew and Gentile alike, why do they go through all this? You know? And so I think Paul is saying, hey, they were made the custodians, you know, of this evidence of God's intention, God's love, God's planning. And so the Hebrew scriptures and Israel's history becomes kind of this powerful moment. You know, it all comes and it puts weight behind this invitation. So it doesn't have to be a revelation to all humankind or any of that stuff, right? And so buried inside of this the Hebrew scriptures, you know, is this foreshadowing of the revelation to come. To me, that, I don't know, it's faith affirming. And because it has that intention and it does that job, it doesn't matter if there are some things in there that we don't maybe agree with in terms of their requirements on other people, that if there are some details that are maybe out of place, if there are things that are maybe exaggerated or overstated, all of that seems beside the point. And what we get instead is, if its purpose is to serve as that kind of testament to God. You know, I use that word maybe to mean something else, but, you know, to serve as that. And it does its job, I think.
I think you're talking about a different model of the inspiration of Scripture.
Right.
So we're, you know, in our series, we're talking about the sort of the doctrine of the inspiration of Scripture, and the version of inspiration that we're tearing down is this inerrancy model. Mm-hmm. But we're actually upholding the inspiration of Scripture. We're saying the Scripture was inspired for a purpose,
right?
Not to be this inerrant manual that has no inaccuracies of any kind, mm-hmm. but rather as a witness, a testimony to God's work with Israel and with Jesus and bringing the gospel into the world.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And it's inspired for that purpose, and it accomplishes mm-hmm. that purpose. You might even say inerrantly, like it perfectly fulfills the purpose God gave it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, imagine somebody's on a vast painting canvas, right? And let's say there are a bunch of people who are all just finger painting on this thing. Okay, yeah, let's just say it's an acre, okay, mm-hmm. and let's just say that there are 40 artists who've all been given a palette, and they're all just, you know, slapping big swaths of paint on it, you know, and you go walking over the top of this, or maybe you can hover over the top of it, and you're like, this is a mess, you know, and you know what? Maybe it is. Maybe some of these artists are better than others. Maybe some of them have a different style than another. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, maybe some are classically trained and some are just to have some basic gifting, and others is just a 3-year-old kid who wants to go around and wallow in some paint, you know? Mm-hmm. And now you can critique certain sections of that, and you can say, man, this is just, you know, your brush strokes are way off here, especially mm-hmm. if you're very trained in artistic styles and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You can say, well, this is just a mess. Mm-hmm. But let's say now you can get in a helicopter, you can get up maybe 1,000 feet or maybe even a few hundred feet and look down on it. And a face comes into view, mm-hmm. you know, and it is a portrait. Mm-hmm. Now, what would that say about that, you know, if you mm-hmm. if you came upon that sort of a
right.
thing?
Right, you would be like, now, it would feel inspired.
Right.
How did this come about? All these different artists, you know, mm-hmm. each of them lacking the larger view, mm-hmm. nevertheless contributed to this larger view.
Right.
There's a mind behind it.
Right, yeah. And they're all, the fact that they're using different styles suggests that they don't maybe even know, mm-hmm. you know, that they're being directed, that they've come there to express themselves and their own background and to relay their own situation, you know, and yet somehow it becomes that. And I would contend that's the Bible. So whereas we might look at the minutiae of it and say, man, this doesn't really meet scratch of what I would think God would do, mm-hmm. you know. And then we begin to say, well, this is clearly a human book, and there's not sufficient evidence to suggest that this had some sort of divine authorship, because anybody can claim such a thing. And I sympathize mm-hmm. with some of those concerns. But when I back away from it, you know, when I see, and I think I may have mentioned before that I set out to do a series on Jesus in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And what would happen when I was preaching at the church would be that I would say I was going to do a series, and then I would have to live with that.
mm-hmm. What did I get myself into?
Right, yeah. And I will, you know, it was agonizing. Every week, I would say, I would reach this crisis of faith. Every week. I would sit there with a passage and in the Old Testament, and I would whiteboard it. I would read it out loud. I would put it on audio Bible and try to listen to it, you know. I would reach a place of utter despond where I would just be like, this doesn't mean anything. You know, I would visualize myself getting and standing in the pulpit and saying, I just don't get it. Which I think I had to always leave that possibility open. Thankfully, I didn't ever have to do that, because somewhere around Wednesday or Thursday, what wasn't there became there. I don't know how to, you know, it was always there, but I could not see it. And then it would just you know, a line. I don't know if you, there's a movie trope, right? Where someone's, they're trying to figure something out and they've got all those, I don't know what it's called, but you know, they got all those strings and the post-it notes mm-hmm. and it's all over the place.
Right.
And then they just kind of back away from it. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like all a face together. Or something, you mm-hmm. know? And that was kind of what happened, but it happened week after week after week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be in this moment of just being, you know, elated and destroyed at the same time. And realizing that he was there where, like, he'd always been there. And I think I had a degree, enough honesty to admit that.
He being Jesus in the Old Testament?
Mm-hmm. I think I had enough honesty, humility. You know, I'm probably the most humble person, you know. Anyway, you know, I think I had enough of that to be ready to say, it's not there, guys. It's just not there. I couldn't see it. I couldn't find it. Every week I had to be ready for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had to, in faith, say, no, but he must be, and just wait.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience with that in this surprising discovery that he had always been there when I could not see him through, you know, I mean, we're talking about 3 good 8-hour days of just wrestling with the text and getting zero. It's not like I was progressing toward an insight.
And for decades, you'd been reading the Bible and you'd read these stories many times over, but now you've assigned yourself this job and you're focusing on the passage.
Right. And then it would just be like, boom, you know, and then it was, the struggle was to try to communicate this because it was such a, it was such a lofty insight, and I was just like, I can't even express this, you know?
What you're saying is you discovered that the Bible was inspired to point to Christ, was inspired to lead us to Christ and the gospel.
Right, right. And so, you know, I've kind of got to this place where, and I've struggled with intellectual doubts my whole Christian life, you know, and I've been very frank that sometimes there have been times when, man, I would have just totally given up if I didn't just need to believe in something beyond this, to be frank, mm-hmm. you know, just my own psychological insufficiencies, I guess, my own weakness and insecurities have kept me from defecting. And yet after that experience, 39 lessons in that series, I don't think I could ever disbelieve because there ain't no way somebody can do this, right? You just can't. There's no way for a human mind to write something that transcends the ages and the era, especially because you see the human element. You see the myopia of the authors, mm-hmm. you know, and their inability to really grasp what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's more affirming.
Mm-hmm. So you're tearing down a certain view of the Bible, but you're not tearing down the Bible.
No.
You're actually amazed at the Bible.
Of course, yeah. But it's because it's demonstrably amazing. If people would take the time to go through the similar struggle to what I went through. Because I think a lot of times people reach that place, you know, I would say that preparing those lessons would move through various phases of what was it? Perspiration, desperation, inspiration, you know, there's these movements. But if you reach desperation and you don't sit with it
mm-hmm.
and wait on God, and you just say, there's nothing here. This is inane. This was written by people who are backward and by my standards are ignorant and immoral. Why am I trying to learn from them? If you get to that place, which I would do every week, but you don't wait and you just say, I think I'm not going to do this anymore. You will spare yourself a little bit of psychological pain, but you will also miss an awareness that's beyond your intellect. And I pity those who miss that. Because it is, you know, it is a powerful experience, and it is a reminder that, you know, that God was always there, that he's embedded in this kind of messy work, you know, mm-hmm. some amazing insight for all humankind that, you know, is demonstrably him. So,
So you're saying that the correct view of the Bible is that it's an, as you wrote, it's an incarnational work given as a companion volume to God's true self-revelation, which is the gospel.
Yep.
You're describing your journey to with the Old Testament, especially coming to see it as the companion volume to the gospel, right, pointing to the gospel, commenting on the gospel, preparing for the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate? Right.
And so when I say an incarnational work, and I'm borrowing this from Robbie Castleman at JBU, so she's out there. But she would talk about how it's an incarnational work that, you know, it's both human and divine. Okay. And it has to be equally human and equally divine. So you read the Psalms, right? And there's a lot of human in there, a lot of complaining, a lot of weakness and sadness and frustration and confusion, along with all of these very lofty praises and comments about God. And so that's just kind of a microcosm of what I mean by incarnational, is that it has to be human. And in being human, I think it has to have what some of us might call flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is humanity without our flaws? Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Something that has no flaws isn't human.
Mm-hmm.
And so if God wanted human authorship, he had to accept us with our flaws.
Mm-hmm.
John Owen, who wrote this obscure book, which I think mm-hmm. is pivotal, landmark, probably the most brilliant work that I've ever read, but it's also super hard to slog through. But he makes the point that if God were to override the will of the authors and dictate through them, that would be an ungracious thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so how is somebody making this, proclaiming a message of grace while ungraciously imposing himself on somebody
mm-hmm.
else?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of inerrancy suggests something about God, that he is a brute, and we just don't see that in him, right? And so this notion that he's able to use someone who has retained their full capacities and who is writing really under their own impetus, certainly for, I think, at least partially good motives, because mm-hmm. we all just have mixed motives, somehow he's able to use all of that to reveal himself. To me, that's more astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he can do that. I sometimes compare. So if somebody reads the Bible, they find contradictions. So let me give you just a real simple one. The story of the centurion that comes to Jesus about his servant. Okay. Mm-hmm. In Matthew, he comes to him in person, and it's kind of important that he comes to him in person. In Luke, he sends, emissaries, Jewish synagogue leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one or the other. And it's, you know, that there's no way to harmonize those two accounts.
Mm-hmm.
He either
seems to be the same event in the life of Jesus, and either did or didn't happen this way.
Right. 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 I mean, take something as iconic as the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Luke sets it on the plain. Come on, Luke. Why do you want to make this hard? You know, mm-hmm. It says. So, you know, it says that he climbed up a mountain in Matthew, and he says he calls his disciples to him, and he opened his mouth and began to speak. In Luke, it says he found a flat place, and he began to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Which one is it? It's like mm-hmm. the opposite, right? And you say, well, these are two different occasions, but the teachings are so very similar that it would be odd, although they're not identical.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself suggests something. You know, is it blessed are the poor in spirit, or is it blessed are the poor? There's a vastly different mm-hmm. meaning there.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
So just in the New Testament, I mean, the Old Testament obviously is, if you compare Chronicles to Kings and stuff like that, there's a lot of things that are not exactly the same. Some things that are unnecessarily outlandish in some mm-hmm. ways, you know. Things that seem to have been exaggerated, not for divine purposes, but maybe for political reasons. So there's some messy stuff in there.
Human stuff.
Right. Now, when I say incarnational, I really compare it to Jesus of Nazareth when he was here on this planet. Okay. Jesus of Nazareth comes. He's fully human. Okay. And he's fully divine. So, you know, and I think I probably use this illustration, but you know, so Jesus is sitting there, he's teaching, everyone's just wrapped, their attention's on him, and you've come back in time. And so you have stupid questions to ask, mm-hmm. questions that other people wouldn't think to ask, but you're like, Jesus, I just was wondering, because where I'm from, we think that the sun is the center and the earth goes around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
What say you, Rabbi?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So Jesus is saying, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, the sun comes up and the sun goes down.
Any idiot can see that.
Right.
Right. Who, what are you
This is the
about?
Incarnation.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the
yes.
human Jesus. This is the human Son of God.
Right. But Lord, the moon is round and the sun is round. Is the earth round? No, stupid.
You know? We all know.
Right. Yeah. Now, does that mean he's not the Son of God?
It does not mean that.
Right.
Right.
Right. So that's kind of what I'm saying is that God is fully able to reveal himself in earthen vessels. And not only can he, I think he prefers to.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we're wrong about a lot of things. You know, it feels like we're getting farther from understanding the universe instead of closer. Does that mean that we can't have a relationship with God, you know, or say things about him that are meaningful or encourage other people? I think we can,
mm-hmm.
you know. But all that to say is I think we need to lose this notion that God ever meant to reveal himself through one authoritative document. That the document was, at best, as Paul talks about it, it was like a stake you put in the ground next to a seedling.
Mm-hmm.
That the revelation, it wasn't even like God, that the law was ever the primary revelation, even under the Mosaic period. That it was always somebody whose heart was for him, who had this Abrahamic faith. So you have David, you know, who, for all of his just disastrous character flaws, is a man after God's own heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who clearly violates Torah, right? And Jesus points out, he went into the temple and ate the showbread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow, okay, how do you get to do that? You know, I mean, why wasn't he stricken dead? I mean, I think he owes Uzzah an apology. God owes Uzzah an apology, you know? That there's something else going on here. Obviously, the record in the Bible is not follow Torah or die, not exclusively. There's something else that God is aiming at, right? It seems to be this faith that he's always wanted. And so, you know, from Abraham to Moses, there's a lot of years, you know. And then, obviously, Israel's away from their cultic worship for 400 years. I mean, it's not like any of those things were essential to the relationship between God and his people. All of those things were support material,
mm-hmm.
for something that was more critical. And it seems to have been this implicit trust, this Abrahamic kind of faith that was always expected. So, you know, that song, probably most people never heard it. Give me that old time religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember when I was first becoming a quote unquote Christian, I guess, in the Church of Christ, and we had very clear dispensational, like there was the patriarchal dispensation, the Mosaic dispensation, and the New Testament. And it's very clearly cut. So when someone would say, give me that old time religion, it's good enough for the Hebrew children, it's good enough for the prophet, mm-hmm. Daniel, I was like, that's not a religion, you know? But it was.
Mm-hmm.
They right. had that same thing.
So there's this gospel message and this faith of the Son, that was really the revelation that was actually there, mm-hmm. From the beginning, experienced right. and lived from the beginning, and the scriptures were there to point to that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's that resurrection faith. It's that faith that defies death and in so doing transcends the world. And I think it occurred rarely among humankind, but it was there. And then with the coming of Christ, we now have the vehicle whereby that can be transmitted.
Right, and that vehicle is the Bible. Oh, wait, right. No, that vehicle is the gospel. So with right. Christ has come the vehicle to transmit the faith to every person on the planet through time, mm-hmm. and that vehicle is the gospel message.
Right, and the Bible is the, I've been planning this for a long time, you know, mm-hmm. and it's obviously true because I've been telling you this. You know, Paul opens the Roman letter, the gospel of God. He says, Paul, a servant of the gospel of God, which he proclaimed in previous times through the prophets. So to me, that's the best, one of the best evidences for believing the gospel is that it was preached 1400 years before Jesus came. And then it was preached, you know, 1300 years before he came, and, you know, 1200 mm-hmm. and all of these figures and stories, apocalyptic literature, poetry, you know, legal documents, all of these things are pointing to one very, very finite point. And that can be that God's intention to bring us there can be seen in these little kind of evidentiary moments, like what we talked about in Genesis 22, this juxtaposition between God, Elohim, and Yahweh, and that they only meet there in that sacrificial moment. You know, to me, that's a very concrete kind of an evidence that whoever wrote it, or whoever, you know, was whispering in the ear of whoever wrote it, you know, mm-hmm. that the intention is that there is this tension between God, mm-hmm. you know, within God, and that it has to be resolved. The fact that there's two manifestations of God that walk between the cut up pieces of the animals with Abraham, you know, and then Paul comes along and says, here's a covenant made without a mediator because God is one.
Thanks, Nathan. That's a lot. Maybe our listeners will have questions. They can email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. We'll pick up next week with literal interpretation. We'll go on from there to the Trinity. Stay tuned for more. Thanks, everybody. See you next time. Bye-bye.